The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On our previous program, we began an article titled Sheer Willpower by Tony Perrottet, The Life of the Last Empress, which was an article about Galla Placidia, who married a barbarian and ruled during the Roman Empire's decline. Where we left off last time, her barbarian husband had just been assassinated, and she was being returned to her brother, her half-brother, the Roman Emperor Honorius. And we'll pick up where we left off. We can only imagine the culture shock Placidia felt leaving the Visigoth band for the imperial capital by the Adriatic. With its dysfunctional court life suffused with decadent luxury, venomous intrigues, and a stifling protocol. Even as a teen, relations with her indolent sibling Honorius had often been contentious. Now, as Placidia had feared, the emperor insisted that she marry his top general, Constantius, who, in stark contrast to the handsome young Altolf, was an aging, clumsy, and shifty war veteran. Some features seemingly attributed to him are bulging eyes, a long, ungainly neck, and a broad head. Constantius preferred a soldier's life to the court, where he often looked depressed and sullen, although he was said to be amusing at feasts when drunk. Despite her resistance, the arranged marriage went ahead, a serious comedown for the former Gothic queen. Once again, Placidia turned the situation to her advantage. Despite his oafish manners, her husband held firm control of the legions and enjoyed a string of victories on the battlefield. Constantius's status was such that in 421, Honorius even promoted the general to rule alongside him, with Placidia given the title Augusta, the highest rank in the empire. Most important, she had two healthy children with Constantius, a daughter, Honoria, and a son, Valentinian. Honorius was still childless, which made her infant boy the undisputed heir to the Western throne. Perhaps because she knew that life was so precarious, Placidia threw herself into religion. In 417, she commissioned a cross-shaped church in Ravenna for royal use, St. Croce, which became one of the artistic wonders of the empire. Its vast dome was designed by master architects from the East using innovative engineering. Its marble floors featured circles of rare purple porphyry from Egypt, and the walls and ceilings glowed with colored marble and stucco. And an image of Christ hovered above the four rivers of paradise. But its most ravishing element was a chapel with ceiling mosaics depicting golden stars in the heavens, surrounded by celestial religious visions. It's like a jewel box, Claudia Frazinetti, a guide at the treasures of Ravenna, whispered in excitement as we approach, then warned. It's quite unimpressive from the outside. You don't expect it to be so beautiful. The chapel's exterior is indeed oddly plain, but those who step beneath its low doorway stop in their tracks with gasps of wonder at the ceiling. 567 golden stars cascade down the cobalt blue night sky, a gorgeous firmament intended to evoke the gateway to heaven above. It's a vision with a power that would not be matched until Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night. In the near sepulchral darkness, one can make out an array of biblical images. Christ the Good Shepherd and his bearded apostles gazing down benignly. A martyr going to his death on a bonfire. Surreal images of the apocalypse drawn from the book of Revelation. Roman mosaics are very dynamic, Frazinetti whispered. You can see the shadows cast by the flames, the movement of the eight apostles. To create the masterpiece, Placidia spared no expense. To achieve the magical effect of the glittering stars, the unknown artist sandwiched a layer of gold leaf between two squares of glass for each mosaic, making everyone a different size so they appear to shimmer as a viewer moves below. Despite her apparent ascendancy, Placidia was keenly aware that family politics within the court of Ravenna were unpredictable, and her position precarious. When her lovely chapel was completed, she reportedly spent whole nights prostrated on the floor beneath the candlelit mosaics, praying fervently and often in tears. Placidia's anxiety turned out to be well-founded. Only months after her elevation as Augusta in 421, her fortunes plunged yet again when Constantius died from a bout of pleurisy. Palace intrigues flourished in the power vacuum that followed, with bizarre rumors spreading that Placidia had become romantically involved with her half-brother. One chronicler reported, "The absence of restraint in their love for one another and their constant kissing on the mouth caused many people to entertain infamous suspicions about them." Relations with Honorius suddenly went awry in 423 when he became convinced that she was dealing behind his back with the Visigoths, and he banished Placidia from Ravenna. She fled to the port with her two young children and hired a ship to travel back to her childhood home, Constantinople. It was a terrifying journey. The vessel nearly sank in an Aegean storm, and Placidia believed her family was only saved by a prayer promising to build St. John the Evangelist a new church. Incredibly, Placidia's adventures only became more dramatic. Not long after her white-knuckle escape from Ravenna, Honorius collapsed from edema and died at age 38. Leaving the throne to be seized by an upstart palace official named Johannes, who was both capable and moderate, but had no royal blood. Placidia had been cultivating the friendship of powerful female relatives in Constantinople. To ensure their family's dynasty continued, they helped convince the Eastern Emperor Theodosius II, Placidia's nephew, to dispatch an army to Italy, depose the usurper, and restore Placidia's six-year-old son, Valentinian, to his rightful position as Emperor of the West. In a stunning reversal of fortunes, Placidia and her two children marched with the legions to victory in 425, then reoccupied the imperial palace in Ravenna. Placidia regained her title, Augusta, and took control of the Western Empire as her son's all-powerful regent. They captured Johannes, suffered the fate of traitors. His right hand was cut off. He was paraded on a donkey, then beheaded before jeering crowds in the chariot stadium. For the next decade, Placidia led the Western Empire personally, playing generals off one another, keeping the deadly intrigues of the court in check, and building alliances to stave off the new threat from the east, Attila the Hun. Even after Valentinian came of age in 437, Placidia, now 47, remained the power behind the throne. She legislated on the minutiae of daily life, and according to historian Hagith Sivan, planned a legal reform to streamline centuries' worth of confusing Roman laws into a single written set, which became a cornerstone of the great project in the Eastern Empire known as the Theodosian Code, the basis of future Roman law in Europe. She took an active hand in church affairs, becoming close friends with bishops around the Mediterranean world, weighing in on urgent theological debates, intervening in a dispute about the succession of the Pope, and promoting worship of the Virgin Mary. Less appealingly, she continued her father's intolerant policy of stamping out non-Christian faiths. She also remained a devout patron of the arts, expanding her building program to edify the faithful. In Ravenna, her new churches included St. John the Evangelist, built to fulfill her promise to the saint for helping her survive the Aegean storm. Today, although largely rebuilt after damage in World War II, The church still has a carving of Placidia over its gate. Her impact was just as powerful in Rome, where she hoped to convert from a secret stronghold of paganism to a beacon of Christianity. She visited regularly, busying herself with pious deeds, forging a friendship with the charismatic Pope Leo I, and beautifying churches. One of her finest commissioned mosaics still graces the walls of the Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. But Placidia had less luck preparing her own family for the responsibilities of ruling, which would one day have catastrophic consequences. Although she made efforts to educate her son, Valentinian, he grew up like his uncle Honorius, distractive, vain, and indecisive. Valentinian was a disaster, sums up Novara of the National Museum of Ravenna. He was weak. He dithered in 440, for example, when North Africa was invaded by another brutal Germanic group, the Vandals. The province was lost, cutting off Rome's main supply of grain, although the emperor scrambled to find replacements from the east. Later, Placidia's daughter, Honoria, became the center of a bizarre Roman sex scandal. Historians do not know why Placidia failed to arrange an acceptable early marriage for Honoria, who proved to be as headstrong a character as her mother. After an illicit affair with one of her palace stewards, she was forcibly engaged to a wealthy senator. In protest, Honoria secretly sent a ring and letter offering her hand in marriage to Attila the Hun, an astonishing act that set Attila, who is referred to as the Scourge of God, on a path to Italy. Psychologists can only speculate. Was Honoria trying to emulate her mother by uniting imperial blood with a barbarian? Her proposal, when it was discovered, was regarded by Romans as treason. The Huns, who rode tough war horses, firing arrows with deadly accuracy, were regarded as the stuff of nightmares. They devoured raw meat, and their ritual facial scars and stocky bodies made them, one Roman author noted, so prodigiously ugly and bent that they might be two-legged animals. Honoria avoided execution. Placidia argued for her daughter's life, but was banished in disgrace. Placidia died quietly in her sleep in Rome in 450 at age 60, presumably secure in the belief that her dynasty was strong and the Christian God would safeguard the empire. She was buried in the Theodosian family sepulcher at St. Peter's Church on the Vatican Hill in Rome. She could have hardly have imagined that within 5 years, her son Valentinian would be slashed to pieces while practicing military exercises on Rome's Campus Martius by two loyal men to a general whom he had murdered. Nor did she live to see her daughter's offer of marriage to Attila come back to haunt the empire in 452. And the Hunnish king and his cavalry stormed into Italy, demanding that Honoria be handed over and the wedding proceed. Placidia's old friend, Pope Leo, personally confronted Attila in the north of Italy and threatened him with divine punishment if he did not turn away. In what was hailed as a miracle, Attila did leave, but according to the chronicler Priscus, Attila's inner circle had urged him to back down, reminding him that Alaric had died shortly after sacking Rome in 410. Leo did not repeat his success when the Vandal armies arrived a few years later. After they pillaged the city in 455, the Western Empire spiraled rapidly toward disaster, then crumbled entirely. The traditional date for the collapse is 476, when a Germanic leader named Odoacer took Ravenna and proclaimed himself king of Italy. The so-called Dark Ages had begun, although historians now argue that the continuities with the Classical Age run deeper than the ruptures. As two historians put it bluntly in a recent revisionist history, the Bright Ages, Rome did not fall. These quote-unquote Dark Ages glowed with erudition and art, creating new starts for civilization that would shape the modern world. The Roman Empire flourished in the East for another 1,000 years, with opulent Constantinople founded as the New Rome, which would later be called Byzantium. Placidia's vision of a peaceful union between Romans and Goths did not endure, but her idea of Christendom as a coherent cultural unit, with Rome as its sacred center, will become a defining feature of Western Europe for centuries. Placidia was an impressive and significant ruler, Salisbury concludes in her book. She had intelligence, that indomitable will and political instincts that let her navigate swift changes in fortune throughout her life. She managed to thrive during the turbulent twilight of the Roman Empire, while many prominent people did not survive. Placidia is also influenced both battles and theology, she adds, and cleverly manipulated male generals and bishops to keep herself in power. Most important for posterity, she recognized the importance of art and architecture in shaping public opinion. Indeed, the Bright Ages starts with Placidia's most enduring legacy, the mosaic-covered mausoleum, as a bridge between the ancient, medieval, and modern worlds. The chapel's ceiling of glittering stars and blue heaven has influenced artists for centuries, including the author of one of the West's greatest works of literature. Dante Alighieri lived in Ravenna for 5 years while writing the Divine Comedy, said Frassinetti when we visited. He certainly came to the mausoleum for inspiration. The painter Gustav Klimt was deeply affected by the city's gold-saturated mosaics during a visit in 1903. He adored the details. But perhaps the most surprising artistic influence was on the American composer Cole Porter, who purportedly wrote Night and Day after gazing in the rapture at the mausoleum's starry ceiling. In her twilight years, Placidia ordered the tiny silver coffin of her infant son, Theodosius, the child she had born at age 24 with Autolf, to be exhumed in Barcelona and shipped to Rome. She arranged for the baby's coffin to be interred alongside her own in St. Peter's, so the two could rest in peace together until the Christian vision of the resurrection would reunite them in heaven. She left no record of her motives, but it seems a moving testament to one of history's most unlikely love affairs between an open-minded barbarian king and a strong-willed Roman princess. Now we'll move on to a little sub-article within this article titled A Run Round Ravenna and Rome. Visit ancient ruins that recall what the cities were like when Placidia ruled the West. Ravenna had emerged as the center of the Western world by the time Placidia arrived in 416. Ravenna attracted the best artists and architects from around the empire, noted Claudia Frassinetti, a cultural heritage specialist and guide in the city. It was the new capital city, the focus of wealth and power. Emperor Honorius, Placidia's half-brother, presided in a magnificent palace overlooking the Adriatic, surrounded by luxury villas for aristocrats, splendid churches, and a stadium for horse races. The port turned into an emporium, Frassinetti added, its warehouses bursting with goods from the Mediterranean and beyond. Today, charming and sleepy Ravenna is often overlooked by travelers entranced by Rome, Venice, and Florence. Even its geography has changed over the last 1,500 years. Its once busy port has silted up and the Adriatic coast receded. Many of its majestic Roman-era structures have simply vanished and been replaced with modest avenues. But in its back streets are gems of ancient art and architecture. Most astonishing is Placidia's mosaic-covered private chapel, which has miraculously survived and is one of the most alluring artistic experiences in all of Italy. A UNESCO World Heritage Site, it is still called the Mausoleum of Galla Placidia, even though she was never buried there. Meanwhile, some 200 miles south in Rome, relics of Placidia's era are scattered throughout the city, often in surprising places. The Annatara Palazzo Neadi Hotel was built on part of the site of the baths of Diocletian. With the capacity to hold 3,000 people, the magnificent complex thrived in Placidia's age. Romans sat immersed in pools under its cathedral-like domes. During the hotel's construction, lovely mosaics from the baths, etc., or changing hall, have been unearthed and they still exist today in the basement. The hotel's guide, an archaeologist named Deborah Quaglieri, showed me the remains of the baths, protected beneath glass in the floor, including mosaics, lead pipes, a cistern, and an octagonal fountain. The Palatine Palace complex is where Placidia grew up with every classical comfort. Today, the ruins have been stripped of their brilliant marble and jewels, but the grandiose arches from tunnels through fields of white flowers. Due to structural issues, some of the most spectacular corridors are off limits. In eerily silence, I follow tunnels to a terrace overlooking the excavated outline of the Circus Maximus, where more than 100,000 spectators once roared during the chariot races. Later, in the Palazzo Massimo Museum, I admired the magical frescoes of citrus-filled gardens that once adorned the chambers decorated by Livia, wife of Augustus. Even more evocative are the surviving sections of the Aurelian walls, a 12.5-mile ring of stone with 380 watchtowers and 12 gates. The 35-feet-high balustrades, previously adorned with marble, were stripped to bare brick in the Middle Ages, but many parts still loom around the historical center and suggest why the Visigoths decided to starve Romans into submission rather than attack them directly. One of its original gates, the Porta San Sebastiano, is now the Museum of the Walls, where I enjoyed sweeping views of the countryside. Finding the Salarian Gate, where the Visigoths broke into the city, was a more difficult task. Within the busy Piazza Fiume, parts of the ancient walls remain, but the gate was severely damaged in 1870 during the capture of Rome and subsequently knocked down. Still, I descended some stairs into the Minerva Bookstore, which is operated for nearly a century underground, and found parts of the stone foundations. A plaque marks the site, but the clerk seemed perplexed when I asked about the walls. He peered at them as if he'd never noticed them before. They did some excavation here once, he shrugged. Next, we'll move on to an article from the prologue section titled The Forgotten Revolution by Melba Newsom. Deep in the archives, a historian rescues the tale of Panama's brave Maroons. A dogged U.S. scholar has upended the conventional wisdom about enslaved Africans in the New World by demonstrating that the first successful slave uprising in the Americas occurred in Panama, not in Haiti, as many have long believed. Robert Schwaller, a University of Kansas historian, discovered new details about the Panama uprising at the General Archive of the Indies, a repository in Seville, Spain, devoted to the Spanish Empire and the Americas and Asia. The papers, including letters, royal edicts, and court documents, shed new light on several groups of enslaved Africans in and around what is now the Panamanian province of Colón. The Spanish explorer Vasco Núñez de Balboa first transported captured Africans to Panama in 1513. Around a decade later, the enslaved population began to flee captivity, first individually, and then in groups. As the ranks of the self-emancipated grew, they conducted raids on Spanish cities and highways to gain riches and to free fellow Africans. These Maroons, an English term used for formerly enslaved people who had freed themselves, tied up Spanish forces in costly guerrilla war for decades, eventually forcing a negotiated peace. In 1579, Panama's High Court granted permanent freedom to resistance leader Macanbique and his community of Maroons throughout Spain's territories in the Americas. The decree, long overlooked by historians, marks the success of this series of uprisings, which took place more than two centuries before Toussaint Louverture helped lead the Haitian Revolution. The success of Panama's Maroons established a precedent for securing freedom and autonomy that other African Maroons would repeat in the centuries to come and Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, and Jamaica, says Schwaller, who details his research in a 2021 book, African Maroons in 16th Century Panama, A History and Documents. The 16th century African freedom fighters formed self-governing settlements in the regions around the Spanish fort of Portobello. More than four centuries later, the Portobello community lives on. The amazing thing about Portobello is that the people who live there today have a direct connection to the people who came from Congo and Angola, many of whom were Maroons, Schwaller says. They know their history, even though few outsiders do. Other scholars, meanwhile, have been celebrating Schwaller's finds. Ben Vincent III, a historian and executive vice president at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, says Schwaller's exceptional work has engineered new pathways for teaching about rebellion, as well as understanding how peace was brokered and how different imperial aims created space for African resistance. We'll finish today's program with one question from Ask Smithsonian. Question: why are so many counties and cities in the original 13 colonies still named after British nobility? Dan Vesco of Haymarket, Virginia asks. It's hard to say for sure why specific places weren't renamed, but overall, the American Revolution brought limited change. From the outset, many colonists opposed it or were indifferent. After the war, the U.S. began rebuilding economic and diplomatic ties with Britain. In contrast, French revolutionaries a few years later beheaded the king, queen, and thousands more and abolished the feudal system. They adopted reforms for education, weights and measures, with new names for everything. Some reforms, like new weeks and months, ultimately failed because people couldn't get used to such radical transformations. Still, for people living in the 13 colonies, free or enslaved, the American Revolution changed life much less fundamentally. That's David K. Allison, curator emeritus at the National Museum of American History. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.